Well, on Sunday evenings, we're looking at the Passion of Christ, as told by John, an eyewitness to these things. And last time we came to the empty tomb, chapter 20, and we looked at verses 1 to 10. Now, do you like mysteries? Do you like riddles? I think you'd make a good detective. Well, as we come to the tomb, the clues are there. John tells us on the Friday, Jesus is dead. Nobody doubts it. And Jesus is buried the same day. But it's all been a bit of a rush. So after the Jewish Sabbath, early on the Sunday morning, Mary Magdalene, she hurries to the tomb to finish those hurried Friday evening burial preparations. She wants to anoint, embalm his body, to do everything properly as it should be done. Now, Mary's not alone, as we saw last time. Elsewhere, other Gospels tell us she's accompanied by other women. And when they arrive, not only has this great stone that's been rolled across the mouth of the tomb, not only has it been rolled away, but the body is gone. And in Mary's mind, there can only be one explanation. We're told at verse 2, when she comes to Peter and John, rather breathless, she says, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. And so Peter and John run to the tomb. And they find that, in fact, Mary, yeah, she's been telling the truth. The body is gone. But the tomb is not empty. The burial shroud in which Jesus' body had been wrapped is still there. Only it's not been unwrapped. It's just that the body inside it is gone. It's like an empty cocoon that's collapsed under the weight of the spices that have been woven into the folds. There's no sign of disorder. There's no evidence that this burial cloth has been unwound. This doesn't look like a grave robbery. What does it all mean? Have you unraveled the riddle? Have you worked it out? Well, John gets it. Verse 8, we read, he saw and believed. Have you done the detective work? All the clues are there. The stone rolled away. No sign of any disturbance or violence or robbery. No one's stolen the body, and yet the body's gone. There can only be one explanation. The explanation no one in the world, least of all these disciples, is expecting. And the explanation, Jesus is risen. But as we come to verse 11, as yet there is no sign of Jesus. This is all about to change. We look at verses 11 to 18. And Mary Magdalene. Now Mary, she came to the tomb with the other women. She then ran off to find Peter and John, leaving the other women behind at the tomb. By the time Mary returns to the tomb, the other women have gone. And as we come to verse 11, Peter and John, they've also come and gone, leaving Mary alone outside the tomb. So please have John chapter 20, verses 11 to 18, open in front of you. We'll simply go through the narrative and then we'll draw the lessons. So verse 11. But Mary stood outside by the tomb, weeping. As far as she's concerned, the grave has been plundered. It's that awful sense, isn't it? Even after he's dead, you still can't leave him alone. And her heart is breaking. But Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping. And as she wept, this is deep, personal grief. Mary's in great distress. You get the sense, don't you? She's close to despair, and all she can do is cry her heart out. But now verse 11, she stoops down, and she looks into the tomb. It's like a low cave. But Mary's eye doesn't fix on that cold stone ledge on which the body of Jesus would have been laid. Neither is she looking at the empty grave clothes. What she sees is two angels verse 12. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. Angels top and tailing where the body had lain. In other words, the explanation for the empty tomb is far from a natural explanation. What's going on is supernatural. Verse 13, then they said to her, woman, and that's a term of respect. It sounds rather cold, doesn't it, in English, but it's a term of respect. They said to her, woman, why are you weeping? It's a gentle question. It's almost as if they're saying, there's no need to cry. And we know Mary's state of mind by the reply that she gives, verse 13. She said to them, because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they've laid him. Here she is looking at angels. Here she is speaking to angels. But the fact that they're angels barely registers, because her mind is elsewhere. She's preoccupied. She's overwhelmed with grief. As far as she's concerned, the dead body of Jesus has been stolen. There's nothing else to say. She can think about nothing else. But now something causes her to turn round. She's aware of another. Verse 14. Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. Why doesn't she know it's Jesus? Well, for a start, she's not expected to see him, is she? She's looking for a dead body. She's not looking for the living Christ. You know what I mean? I'm sure it's happened to you. I've been on holiday and you meet a colleague from work, and of course you're not expecting to see them, are you? You only ever see them at work, and here you are on holiday. Not only that, is that you only ever see them in a suit. And on holiday, there they are in a t-shirt and shorts, looking very casual. And as you look at them, you think, I'm not even sure it's them. Because it's the wrong setting, and they look different. And maybe they even wave to you, and you sort of half wave back until it clicks. Yeah? That may have been some of the explanation why Mary doesn't recognize Jesus. But there's more. Because Jesus is now risen from the dead. He's clothed with a resurrection body. Incorruptible, glorious, powerful, spiritual. You can read about it. It's the stuff of 1 Corinthians 15. It is him. But he looks different. It's a resurrection body. Remember, this is the body that can pass freely through the grave clothes. So it's a change in Jesus' appearance. Hence, Mary, through her tears, doesn't recognize him. It doesn't register. Verse 15, Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? Again, it's a gentle question, isn't it? And if this man is a stranger, well, they're very kind questions, aren't they? And it's also a knowing question. Whom are you seeking? Who are you looking for? Well, how does he know she's looking for someone? Unless, of course, he's more than a stranger. And if she's looking for a corpse, why does he, in his question, speak of someone who's alive? How does the stranger know all of this? Whom are you seeking? And she, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away. And once again, we're reminded of Mary's state of mind. You see, John is just telling us things as they are. This is all very human. These are real events, real people. We know exactly what where Mary is, because her thoughts are dominated by Jesus. She just gives a short reply, but in that short reply, she speaks of him three times. Whom are you seeking? She's opposing him to be the gardener, said to him, Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. It's all about him, him, him. That's all she can think about. It's also deeply moving. Think of it. She says, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away. And you have to say, well, Mary, how are you going to do that? How are you going to carry the body of a full-grown man? It'll be beyond you, Mary. It's impossible. But you see, all we're reading here is the strength of her devotion. She'll do it. She'll stop at nothing to do it. She'll let nothing, as long as she can do something for him. And now as we come to verse 16, it seems that Mary is now turned away from the stranger. But now he speaks one word. And it's only one word. But it's her name. Her name spoken as only he would speak it. The translation here says Mary. But her native tongue is Aramaic. So Jesus would have said to her, Mariam. And no one ever spoke her name as he spoke her name. And when he says to her, Mariam, the recognition is instant. Jesus said to her, Mariam, she turned and said to him, Rabboni, which is to say, teacher. And all that pent-up love, it now comes pouring out. You can hear it in her voice. Oh, I can't communicate it, and none of us could communicate how she must have said Rabboni in that moment. But all that love that's in her heart, it breaks forth into that cry of recognition. And she holds on to him. I've lost you once. I'm never going to lose you again. Jesus has to say to her, verse 17, don't cling to me. The Greek is stop what you're doing. Mary, let go. Don't cling to me, for I've not yet ascended to my Father. Mary, I'm not going anywhere soon. I will be ascending to my Father, but I haven't gone yet. I'm not about to disappear to heaven. And there's a job for you, Mary. A job that only you can do. There's good news to share. I need someone to share it. So Mary, go to my brothers and say to them, verse 17, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Everything's changing. An empty tomb. A resurrection. And now Jesus is speaking of a new relationship. Jesus speaks of his disciples as brothers. Well, that's new. And up until now, when he's spoken of the Father, well, it's been the Father or my Father. Well, Mary, you go and you tell my disciples that the Father, my Father, he's now your Father. I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Now, Jesus uniquely is the Son of God, the eternal Son. He's a son by right, but through him there will now be sons by adoption. Everything's changing. And Mary, who would have thought it? She's a woman. I know it's a statement of the obvious, but she's a woman. And a woman's testimony in that culture wasn't even accepted in a court of law. But Mary, you're the first to go with the good news. She She's the first to see Jesus. The first to bear the good news that he's risen. Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. Well, we draw the lessons. They're just three very simple lessons. The first is this, Mary's devotion. Now, what do we know of Mary? Well, Luke in his gospel tells us that out of Mary had come seven demons. She was under the control of these evil spiritual entities. It was a nightmare existence until she met Jesus with that word of authority, with that voice of command. He literally banished her demons. But she didn't go back to her old life, to the old Mary. On the contrary, Jesus gave her a new life. And that heart, which once had been occupied by Satan, that heart now overflowed with love for Jesus. So it's no surprise that we find her, John 19, verse 25, standing at the cross. When everyone else has run away, she's not ashamed. Not ashamed of her Lord. Not ashamed of his cross. And Matthew tells us that she watches as the body is buried. And she's up at the crack of dawn on the Sunday to return to the tomb. In other words, when it comes to Jesus, Mary is the last to leave and the first to arrive. And she refuses to give in, doesn't she? Even when she faces impossible obstacles. I mean, there's one obvious obstacle. Who's going to roll away that great big stone? It rolls down a little slope, so it's easy to close the tomb, but it's virtually impossible to open it again. And as we were thinking about verse 15, Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away. Mary, how can you carry his body? But he's telling you the sort of woman that Mary is. Her devotion knows no limits. Whatever the obstacle, she'll do what she can do. And when the men are nowhere to be seen, Mary is there. When the men have given up and gone home, Mary won't rest until she's done something for Jesus. Whatever the difficulties, whatever the cost. So do you see? Freely forgiven, she freely loves. Having spent years a slave to Satan, she now gives her life to Jesus. And her devotion knows no limits. Which is why when she hears Jesus say, Mary, well, it all comes pouring out, doesn't it? And she holds on to him so hard, I never want to lose you again. So Christian friends, and particularly ladies and girls, what of you? What are you known for? Are you known for the way you dress? That you're obsessive about your children? Are you known for being faddish about your diet? Or self-absorbed and moody? Maybe you're never being cliquey. You have a circle of friends. You never look beyond the circle of friends. It's just you and your friends. You certainly don't talk to anyone else. Or are you so focused on your family that you show no love towards other families? What are you known for? And when it comes to Jesus, are you the first to arrive and the last to leave? And are you unashamed to be identified with a crucified Lord? Are you unashamed of his cross? And do you linger around Jesus? That's the sense you have in Mary, don't you? She's lingering. She can't pull herself away. Are you like that? You're watching, waiting, looking, longing just to be near to him. just to meet him, just to do something for him, anything. What's the measure of your devotion to Christ? The measure of your devotion to Christ in this church. And am I the one who runs to others with the good news? That sense of commission, that sense of calling, that I can go and tell them the good news about Jesus Christ. So, my friend, it's a very simple question, isn't it? Look at Mary. Look at the woman she is. She's a woman who loves Christ fervently. So, my sister, do you love Jesus fervently? Do you? If you do, then don't be surprised if you see angels. And expect to hear Jesus speaking to you by name. You can be sure he knows your name. And expect to enjoy communion with your Lord. When you look at this, you think, well, who was Mary? Who's Mary? But you see, the last shall be first. The second lesson is this, Jesus' tenderness. Verse 11, but Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, Mary's brokenhearted. And you have the sense that she's standing on the edge of a precipice. A precipice of despair. Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. She's broken hearted. And then when we read verse 16, Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned around, Rabboni. As we said, it's an Aramaic word. It's in her own dialect. She's Mary Magdalene. She's Mary from Magdala. Magdala in Galilee, where they speak Aramaic. Now, when Jesus says to her, verse 15, Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? There's no response, is there? She's completely unfazed by it because it's the voice of a stranger. But when he says to her, Mary, Mariam, he speaks to her in her own dialect, her own name. Spoken as only he can speak it. Spoken to her heart. It's only one word. But it's all she needs to know. It's not the voice of the gardener. It's the voice of the shepherd. And his sheep hear his voice. And you get this wonderful sense, don't you? Of the tenderness. There's a great economy in this, isn't there? Economy of expression, economy of language. He just says one word, but everything is in that word. It's a world of disclosure, of knowing, of love, of tenderness. Everything is carried, conveyed in that word to Mary. And how tender Jesus is with his broken-hearted child. And Christian friends, he's the same Jesus, isn't he? The same yesterday, today, and forever. And were her tears really necessary? Hear the words of the angels. Verse 13, Woman, why are you weeping? You can tell that two ways, can't you? Hear the voice of Jesus. Woman, why are you weeping? It's not just a question of what's going on, but it's actually, why are you weeping? Things are not what they seem. Now, Mary's weeping because the body's gone. But the fact is, the body's gone because he's risen. The cause of her tears is actually the cause of her joy. And that's why she runs back to Mary Magdalene, came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. The Lord's tenderness. Christian friend, are you on the edge of a precipice? And Jesus doesn't know? He's the same, isn't he? Yesterday, today, and forever. He sees into Mary's heart. He knows. He feels. His hand is on her pulse. He's tender. He understands. He sees. And my friend, sure, all our words to you, they change nothing. And we try to speak kindly to you, but you don't hear. I think if angels came, as he did to Mary, and spoke to you, you wouldn't hear. Because of your grief, your trial, your heartache. But one word from him, calling you by name, and all will be well. Our tender, loving friend. Isn't that why in Scripture again and again we read a word to those who are on the edge of the precipice? And what's the word? The word is wait. Wait for the Lord. The psalmist says, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I do hope. My soul waits for the Lord, more than those who watch for the morning. Yes, more than those who watch for the morning. My friend, in your despair, wait, wait. Jesus knows. And one word from him, and all will be well. And anyway, Christian friend, most of what we fear never happens. Remember Jacob? He said, all these things are against me. No, they're not, Jacob. They're all going your way. And Mary, she's weeping because the body's gone. But exactly, Mary, that'll be the cause of your joy. It's gone because he's risen. So, Christian friend, hold on. Don't despair. He knows. Wait for him. And soon you will hear his footfall behind you. And he who knows your name will speak. But the third point is this, the third lesson is this. We'll call it the back of the wardrobe. You know, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, back of the wardrobe, there's Narnia. Now, on Friday, I went up to a street cleaner and I thanked him for sweeping our road. And I gave him this little card. And on this little card there are four pictures, and there's a picture of a Catholic church, picture of a Buddha, of a mosque, and the fourth picture is of some Hindu statues. And the caption reads, but there are so many religions. And there are, aren't there? So many religions. And what does that prove? Well, it proves, isn't it, that we all feel that we need something more. That life is more than what I touch and what I see. But what is it? I know there's something more, but what and where? And we have a sense, don't we, that there must be some God there somewhere. There must be some power behind it all. Which is why when we're in trouble, we pray. We have that sense of dependency. We have that sense that there's someone to whom I'm accountable. There's someone who's behind it, who's in charge. And there are times when we feel bad about things and we feel we need to make amends. And we all, even if we're an atheist, we all, if we're honest, believe in a hereafter. All of us are looking for another world at the back of the wardrobe. But so many religions, and they contradict each other. So is it all rubbish? Or is one real? This little episode, just a few verses, tells you that one of them is genuine. All religions are about following a way of life. True Bible Christianity is about following a person, Jesus Christ. Well, what makes Jesus worth following? Verse 16, Jesus said to her, Mary. Jesus lives. He's the only man ever to have been killed and then come back from the dead. All these have their tombs in which their leader lies dead. Christ came back and is alive. And in that death and resurrection, everything changes. Jesus said to her, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. He died upon that cross, pinned out like an insect, nailed into his hands and into his feet, but he was dying the punishing death we deserve to die. So that all who come to Jesus, all who trust in him, can enjoy peace with God. They can speak of God as our God. They can know God as Father, our Father. Mary thought she was talking to the gardener. And you know, she was. Adam was the first gardener. He walked out on God. He ruined it all. Paradise lost. Well, here is Jesus. He's the last Adam. He's the new gardener. He ascends to heaven from where he makes everything new. And one day he'll restore the creation. And where thorns now grow, flowers of paradise will burst forth. He's making lives new now, here on earth. Which is why Mary's story, not this particular details, but the deliverance and being saved and being changed and being forgiven. Mary's story has been repeated countless times. Because this is a Jesus who meets with us, who comes speaking our name, who calls us to himself. This is the Jesus who saves to the uttermost. Or else someone's thinking you're getting carried away. Well, let's make it very simple. Suppose we could condense 100 years into 24 hours. And here we all are, sitting in a room. And we're all under sentence of death, aren't we? And the reason we're under sentence of death is because the Bible tells us the wages of sin is death, eternal punishment in that other place. 100 years condensed to 24 hours. And every hour, some of us are butchered. We die. And the rest of us look on. We watch. And then we weep. And then we wait our turn. And a year passes in 14 minutes. Some of us leave the room in the first hour. After 5 hours, a number have left the room. We know this is serious. By 18 hours, most of us have been butchered. As Jim Morrison said, no one gets out of here alive. Which is why, what are we doing? We're all feeling the walls for a way out. We're looking for a door to life. There's got to be one somewhere. That's why there are so many religions. Everyone's looking for the door. Because we're all going to die. And time's running out. And I've seen so many die. It'll be me soon. I've got to find the door. I've got to find the way out. There's got to be a door, a way to salvation. There's got to be a new world somewhere out there where I'm not condemned, where I can be forgiven, where I can live forever. The world at the back of the wardrobe. So many religions, but they're all false doors. Because there is only one door. It's the real door. There's only one safe way out. There's only one way to be forgiven. There's only one way to be right with God. There's only one door to paradise. And it's not the back of a wardrobe. It's the empty tomb. Or rather, it's because of the empty tomb. Jesus Christ, by his death, by his resurrection, has done everything necessary to save me. To save all, any, whoever you are. Whether your name is Mariam or otherwise. To save all who fall upon his kind arms. God be merciful to me, a sinner. What did he say? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. There's only one door. Go to my brothers and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. My friend, the empty tomb. It's the most wonderful news. And it changes everything. And everything has changed. There's a way out. I don't have to sit here and wait to be butchered. It's not religion. It's not a way of life to live. The answer is a wonderful person. And it's he who has the keys to death and Hades. So go to him. Lord, I've messed up. I've sinned. I've wronged you. I'm beginning to understand. I've got to come to you. And there are things I don't understand, but I know I've got to come to you. And there are things I've got lots of questions, but I know I've got to come to you. And you could come to him tonight. So go to him. Lord, change me. Save me. Forgive me. And you know the amazing thing? Some of you have seen others butchered. Even in the last hour. And you wait your turn. And for all you know, it could come in the next minute. And the extraordinary thing is this. You know the way out. But you refuse to take it.